Welcome to the show. Welcome to Three Women, Three Ways. We are the show that tackles some tough topics. And I think I say this so often, but it's really true. This topic, I think, is one of the toughest that we ever have to cover. This topic happens way too often. And although we've had different experts in the field of what happens in family courts and the proceedings that go on there when women fight for custody, it's one thing to look at it from academic studies. It's another thing to look at it from real life experience. And we have Natalia with us today. Natalia, welcome.
Hi.
Okay. Yeah, welcome to the show, Natalia. And we have attorney John Mosley with us. They're both in Virginia. Welcome, John.
I'm good to be here. Kind of wish there were better circumstances, but...
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's tough. These, you know, it's not just tough to experience, it's tough to hear. But we need to hear. We need to hear what's going on. Natalia, you've had a particularly egregious custody battle and divorce, I'm assuming. And boy, is there a high cost to pay. Everything from the money and the emotion to all the way up to going to jail for that cost. Do you agree that there's a way too high cost to try to protect your children, Natalia?
Yeah, there's a high cost that I had to spend a lot of money. Yes.
Well, there's an emotional cost.
Oh yes, my life, my financial life, and my way of living and everything has changed dramatically since I lost custody, and I've been fighting this battle for the last 3 or 4 years. So yeah, it's been a roller coaster. As far as jobs and financial and my emotional well-being and trying to, you know, pay lawyers. And I even had to file bankruptcy because it got so bad.
Yeah. Well, and then once you don't have money, it's hard to get representation. John, you're there. You're working with Natalia. What can you add to her comments about the financial burden of this?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is a terrible thing, and most people, I think, don't imagine how far, you know, when they get started, what it's all going to take, and things that shouldn't be so complicated and confusing and expensive end up being a endless drama that that people don't really anticipate. I have a lot of people, you know, I don't charge very much around here. I keep my, but by the time most people find me, they've already been drained with so many other lawyers, often I think bad lawyers and bad experiences. And you say it's true. It's bad enough to have all the bad experiences that courts can give, but then trying to unravel it when, you know, they've already been depleted and financially and in every other way, it just adds to the loss of rights and the box that people are in.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to tell you also, in my cases, I went through like about 4 or 5 lawyers because I couldn't keep up with just maintaining one lawyer. And I thought because I was very good at building a very strong case and bringing a lot of evidence into the court, and looking like the more reasonable parent, I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to go to this court once or twice, and I was going to get my, you know, my son back. Because with my evidence, I thought it was like the judge was going to be like, oh, yeah, she's the more reasonable parent. She seems like the more parent who's more for the child. This other parent is more about alienation, about getting back at the other parent and punishing her and taking away her time away from the child. And I thought, and when I was going to court, that the judge was going to look higher at me. Instead, she looked at the bad parent instead of looking at the good parent. And then I went on many radio shows besides yours, and I'm learning that a lot of these other parents are having the same problem where their children are being left with the abuser, and mothers are losing their rights and their parental rights. And a lot of it has to do with the judges feel, or they feel like if we leave the child with the bad parent, then we get more revenue into the court. As where if we give it to the good parent, then we kind of lost the case. So,
well, you
I don't know.
Jen, I want to address this because I spoke with a researcher, a renowned researcher, who has been looking into this, and I kind of got in trouble with him because during a radio show, I referred to the child court industry and indicated that there's a lot. It seems to me that poor people don't seem to go through these fights as much as people who have some means, and until it seems to be until those means are exploited and gone. He got a little upset with me for saying that, but I mean, I've never heard of people who don't have the funds to pay the psychologists and the guardians ad litem and all of that going through such huge struggles over child custody. Is that because they just kind of get screwed at the beginning and they're done with it? Or how do you see this, John? Straighten me out.
Well, I haven't seen, I don't know about a study, but it happens, of course, when one parent has the resources to hire all those consultants and things. I've definitely seen that. So I don't know that it matters that both parents necessarily have money to spend. But I would say that in this case, I mean, I definitely feel like money bought justice. That the father, you know, had the fancy psychiatrist and all these other people to come in, and I believe the judge was very swayed by just who had the fancier consultants, and not who had the better case, not who had the better thing, but it's almost like if you can hire all these experts, then you you can buy any result you want. And you know, I understand that, you know, the judge looks like, well, I have this expert here, and he testified, and he said all these things, and so, you know, he could somewhat see that argument, but I think a judge could possibly see through all that as well.
Problems with hiring those experts is that a lot of times, just because they have initials after their name doesn't mean that they understand a situation. I know.
No, they don't.
I've been kind of gobsmacked by psychologists, and my field is psychology, and I'm always just kind of, if you're doing one-on-one therapy, of course you just take the client's word for what they're experiencing in their lives. But if you're filing a forensic report, if you're filing a report for the court, how can you blithely say this is what this one person said, and so therefore this is the gospel, this is what is happening, this is what the other party is doing, this is how it's impacting? You know, it seems so one-sided to me, and I'm always just gobsmacked by that.
The son, Natalia's son, had both a psychiatrist and a therapist hired by the father. The psychiatrist said that he was, you know, he gave all this outrageous testimony about how Natalia was harmful to her son's development. The son has behavioral problems, has ADHD. Their whole theme was that her involvement was interfering with this therapy. But then on cross examination, the psychiatrist who's prescribing the medication, it's, oh, I'm not really listening. I'm not really trying to get the child to open up and tell me what's going on because he has a therapist. So he says, I'm not trying to create a therapeutic relationship with the child. He just sees him for half an hour and just talks a little bit about things and intentionally says he doesn't get into getting the child to open up because that's what the therapist does. But that's not the impression he gave the court with all this outlandish things. And then when I ask him on cross-examination, like, well, how do you know that this is, you know, that Natalia is having any negative effect on the child? So she admits he's just guessing. It's like, well, I mean, because the only people are there in that conversation are Natalia and the child. Nobody else is there. So how do you know what's happening? She says, well, I just think that's probably what's happening. There's absolutely no basis for it whatsoever. And then the therapist, of course, doesn't have the qualifications of the, you know, isn't dealing with the medication. So they're both going in there and giving all this, giving the impression of that they've come to this conclusion, but when you really take it apart, you know, they're like doubles tennis. They're not actually getting into it at all, but they're perfectly willing to get in there.
The judge is listening to their testimony as gospel, as if it from straight from the hand of God down, you know, to them.
Right.
It's just kind of amazing.
Well, but you know what? Also, the judge knows very well that she put orders where I can't have contact with either one. So she's a smart judge. She's the chief judge of the Alexandria Court. She knows very well that those two witnesses are coming in to speak on the father's behalf, that they don't even have any interaction with me. And then half of what they're saying is just a whole bunch of lines that she got, that he got, they got from the father to just to be on the father's side. So, yeah, I just think all of them are just.
I mean, I asked, another thing might be important for many people to think about is that I asked the therapist in cross-examination, you know, who is your patient? Who do you answer to? And, you know, they were like puzzled by the whole idea. And basically they admitted that they're, you know, that they were hired by the father. And this is what I find very offensive is that no matter how young the child is, their patient is the child. But it's clear that it's clear in every respect the way they're acting. They're acting as if the whoever pays them is, it's like as an attorney. If somebody hires me and a relative pays, it's very clear that I owe the responsibility to the client, not to the person who pays me. But in this area, you know, it's pretty clear that the experts answer to whoever writes their check, not the best interest of the child who they're supposed to be treating.
You'd for sure get some discussion about that in the psychology circles. I've read journal articles, et cetera, on that particular issue. But I think that it's a valid point. I think that's a very valid point. Even if it's not conscious allegiance, there is an allegiance to the person who's paying your bill or the person who contacted you first.
So, and the therapist, you would think that a therapist who means well and wants what's best for the child, she would try to meet with both parents, right? This therapist has never, ever called me in her office. Even the order says that she can call me or, you know, invite me in for a session. I can't go to the sessions, but she can invite me. And not once has she made any effort to have any contact with me or invite me in or get to know me. And then she went on the stand and she basically bashed my character like if she knew, based on what the father is telling her, not anything that she knows about me because she doesn't know me personally. She's probably seen me twice in court for a second.
Boy. It's so convoluted. We should probably back up a little bit and explain what it is. If you had to pick the top three reasons that Natalia is in the position of having to fight for custody of her child, John, what would they be? What wrong here, so to speak?
Well, there's several things, and part of the issue is that there was a previous round of court hearings, but because the child has some difficulties, then there was some various help, and in previous years the court ordered that Natalia can't talk to the doctors and psychiatrist treating her child. So that was the first error, and I think that is a completely outrageous position. I think that the court should not interfere in the medical relationship. I don't think the court is qualified or it's proper in any way, but that's what the court ordered, was that she cannot talk to the doctors, psychologist, or therapist treating her child. And then when the medication went wrong, and she was trying to raise it to the adult's attention, and it's a lot like we see in a lot of areas where everything gets twisted, spin and things like that. So her attempts to point out that the medication they're putting them on is causing problems are then turned around and twisted, and as if she is interfering in his treatment. I got the psychiatrist to admit, Dr. Michener, on the stand that he needs to know what's happening with the child with the medication he's prescribing. And in fact, he did change the medication as he testified. And he starts out with this whole thing that's saying her involvement is detrimental to the development of the child. And then when I ask him questions, he gets around to saying, "Oh yeah, of course, it's valuable to know the feedback from every adult in the child's life." So he, you know, his testimony that I started out with, that he started out with on his own, was like 180 degrees the opposite when I asked him questions. So, you know, and he's this warm, grandfatherly Pepperidge Farm remembers kind of guy. So, you know, so the judge liked him. The other thing is that they tried to point out is that the child tells, and this is a problem that a lot of people are going to face, the child reports to many adults that the father has abused him. I mean, in terms of violence, not in terms of other things. And but the judge would not let the minor child testify. 10 years old has some problems, and so whether or not a young child can testify is kind of for the judge to evaluate. So you've got this problem where you've got allegations of abuse, but everybody is trying to talk about it, and the elephant in the room is the judge won't let the child testify. So what we have is everybody's opinion about what the child said, which is not reliable. Then Natalia took the child to the magistrate, who's in Virginia, is a lower judge who evaluates protective orders and things like this. The magistrate spent 15 minutes alone with Ethan, the child, and so some people watched. We got testimony into the court that the magistrate, you know, interviewed the child directly and alone, then issued a protective order, ordered the child out of the father's custody, ordered the police to go over and get his things, and so obviously the magistrate was convinced from what the child said on his own, but the judge wouldn't have the child testify in the actual court hearing.
So the judge also then disregarded what the magistrate reported or what the magistrate found?
Absolutely. She can't, but she did. I brought that up, and the judge was angry when I pointed out, says the only judicial officer who's heard the child directly believed the abuse. And she got angry and says, yeah, but, you know, maybe, you know, he didn't fully investigate, and she just kept making all these excuses to why maybe it isn't true. Then during the pendency of this...
If there's any flake of a doubt, why would you risk the child being placed back in that situation?
I don't know, and it gets even worse because the father's attorney then argued that because Natalia reported it to the magistrate, to the proper authorities, for that reason, her rights should be taken away. And the judge basically in the transcript agreed that because Natalia reported physical abuse to the proper authorities, that this was disruptive to the child, and she's lost custody in part because she reported abuse. And it's in the, you know, it's in there's a transcript in which Judge Kemmler announced her order. It's not my opinion. It's, you know, you can read it in the transcript for yourself. I'll send it to anybody. Hello?
John, I'm taking another call. We have a reporter who works closely on this situation, and I'm hoping that he'll answer his phone.
Yes,
are you there, Michael?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Michael Volpe, author and reporter, is joining us. We've been talking about the high cost, both financial and emotional. I think we've pretty much moved into the emotional cost of fighting for your child. And we talked a little bit about the financial cost and how difficult it is when one party has lots of money and the other party doesn't in these child custody issues. But now we're talking about how the judge, it almost seems like judges are kind of capricious on choosing what they will believe and what they won't believe. And I've often said mm-hmm. that the one with the biggest stack of paper on the most expensive stationery is the one that the judges believe. But then I'm notorious for saying things that get me in trouble. Michael, how would you respond to my comment?
Well, I think more often than not, you're right. You know, in each case, it has its own dynamic. I think you've got Natalia on the phone as well.
Yes.
Yeah, right. I did. Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I look, like in her case, when she had physical custody, they went to court once. So since it's been switched in 2014, somewhere around 100 times. Now, think about the billable hours and all of the court services that created and all of the money around that. And so that's not only is that a red flag, but that really shows what this is all about. This is all about creating billable hours, and there just weren't enough when Natalia had custody. She switched custody, and you know, not just for the lawyers, but for guardian ad litem. I think in her case and other cases, you can bring in a whole bunch of other people, and they're all making $200, $400 an hour. So certainly the one who can afford to pay it is the one they're going to cater to. And that's, as you said, the one with the biggest stack of paper from the best law firm.
And if I could complete... Go ahead.
Sure, go ahead, John.
No, I was going to complete a thought that you didn't know I was going to add to that. Is that the guardian ad litem asked for the judge ordered while the case was pending, which went over several months because to schedule a day here, a day there, and Natalia was ordered to have supervised visitation only. And it's a real pain in the neck to get supervised visitation. The judge that thinks, I'll just order it. It's very expensive, very difficult. There are very few people do it, and they don't do it as a primary. You know, they do it as a part-time job. So we settled on someone that the judge liked, that the guardian ad litem liked, and Natalia had visitation with what was her name?
Lori Best,
Lori Best met with the child and immediately reported the abuse to Child Protective Services. And I asked Lori Best, why did you report? And that was only a few weeks. That was in the middle of the proceedings.
Abused by the custodial parent, not Natalia.
And it says, why did you, I asked her in court about this before the judge. Why did you report the same thing that happened before the magistrate? She said, well, I was required to. I'm a mandatory reporter. So what she heard from the child as well, only a few weeks before, obligated her to report it. And yet the judge didn't believe either the magistrate or the supervised visitation who made the report.
What's even more interesting is the judge turned to her on the stand and said, I don't want to hear what the child told you. I don't want to hear it.
We've seen this over and over again, these kinds of situations. Isn't there any accountability for these judges?
Very, very little. Do you know what I recently found out? So I didn't recently find this part out, but in each state they have but I think most of the states have a judicial oversight board. Like in Oklahoma, it's called the Council on Judicial Complaints. In California, it's the Council on Judicial Commission, I think. And so if you look, if someone's actually done, like they did one for the one in Florida, and it was 400, 500 complaints per year, and three or four actions taken. And their reason is, most of the complaints are frivolous. And you look at all of these state judicial complaint places, and they all have these kinds of numbers where there'll be several hundred complaints in a year, and they'll take action on three or four, and their reason always is, most of them are frivolous. And of course, who's saying that they're frivolous? The judicial complaint place. So you're saying accountability, and these are, in each state, there's a place that if a judge is out of control, you're allowed to complain, and what you're going to find is, they take action in a handful of cases, even though they'll get hundreds of complaints per year, and they'll tell you, that's because most of these litigants are just filing frivolous complaints. And we don't know if they're frivolous because they're the ones claiming it. So, no, there's very little accountability.
Frivolous to whom? And that's an interesting comment, because frivolous to them may not be frivolous to me.
Right. Right. Well, their argument is, that they can only take action like a statute. So, their argument gets in all kinds of legalese. So what they're saying is, you think that it's a violation, and it's not technically a violation. You're just upset with the judge, this, that, and the other. In other cases, judges are nominated and renominated. So
I want to get back to the judicial accountability. Because there was, speaking of notorious cases, there's the Grazini, am I saying it correctly, case in Michigan last year, which was notorious, and we don't need to go into that, but there were complaints filed in that case because it got a lot of publicity for some pretty wild behavior on the part of the judge, and the judge was brought before that judicial commission, and what happened to her?
Well, I think you're talking about the Simone case. Ultimately, initially there was talk that she was going to be suspended for 12 months. She wasn't, not only was she not suspended, but later on, some organization gave her an award for helping the children. So basically, she got a slap on the wrist and
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Her first day back in the courtroom, it was stuffed with people who stood up and gave her a round of applause after being reviewed by this commission.
Oh, my God.
And sanctioned.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Like, this is a judge who put three kids in the juvenile hall because they refused to have lunch with their father because they said he beat them. You know, it gets...
Yeah.
Number one, yeah. Just the shock value that you put kids in the juvenile hall for that reason. Number two, it was the parents' divorce. You know, this gets into a technical area, but what the court overseeing her found is you can't do that because it's the parents' divorce. You don't have power over them. You can't force the kids in the parents' divorce to do at your will.
Things you do to a bunch of normal kids. What a horrible
right.
thing.
Oh, yeah. These three kids.
Them life?
Right.
Crazy.
They all were straight A's.
Yep.
Listen, these kids were straight A's. Everyone liked them. Their entire world was turned upside down, not just with Jermel Hall. Then she sent them to a camp to reunification therapy. She kept them away from their mom for about 6 months. She threw their lives in the complete chaos for no reason whatsoever. They gave her a slap on the wrist. She was going to be suspended for a year. That would have been a legitimate punishment. And then some organization even gives her an award.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, well,
I want to pull back to Natalia's case here. And one of the things in this conversation that is puzzling me is you are being punished. As a matter of fact, you were punished to the point where
yeah, I am. The father told me that he was going to punish me one day and take Ethan away and ask me for child support. And now he has all these, the judge and he has the GAL and his lawyer, and they're all friends with each other, and they're all, it's like a big, happy, I don't know. I even feel like the day that I went to jail, I almost feel like, the two guardian ad litems were there, like happy that I was going to jail. I mean, it was chaotic to see what was going on in the courtroom. How everybody was just on one side, and they were all like friends.
Yes,
right.
These people work together. You know, they work together. Plus, John, you were saying that there's a cost for an attorney who might question a judge's decision. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the rules of the bar that govern attorney conduct from which you can be disciplined or disbarred prohibit attorneys from saying certain things about judges. You can't, the way it's worded is you can't question the fitness or qualifications of a judge. But basically, it works out to say you can't say anything negative about a judge if you're an attorney. And so when people are trying to figure out what's going on, you have to realize that most of the attorneys are silent because they're not allowed to tell people what's going on. The theory is that if an attorney is critical of judges, that it will lessen confidence in the judicial system, which it should.
We've had former attorneys on our show who were disbarred in these kinds of situations, one in California and one back east, and because they challenged the judge's decisions and made some noise, they were actually disbarred. And I find that astounding that you can't criticize decisions. The more that I hear about these situations, I think this is such an archaic system where one party, i.e. the judge, seems to have iron control, and whatever that party's whim. I'm going to digress here for a second, because I remember years ago, I mean, I'm talking decades ago, whenever there was malpractice, when I was a kid, there you didn't have malpractice lawsuits. The medical societies kind of policed their own. And at one point, people were saying, wait a minute, this is not exactly the best way to do this. And so they got away from that, and they, you can argue whether what we've gone to is better. I don't know. I'm not in the medical field. But at one point, whenever you had a complaint about a doctor, it went to the medical society, and they reviewed their own. And it sounds very similar to these judicial review boards. The issue with the doctors, though, was resolved like 20-some years ago or more when they said, wait a minute, policing your own is not necessarily the way to go here. It seems to me like policing your own, although it brings problems, is probably not the best way to go for judges either, but nobody can stand up and argue with the judges.
One can speculate that if they start to disciplining judges, it will you know, open the idea that maybe there really is our problems, you know, so better to cover it up, sweep it under the rug. But my father's a retired doctor, and when he ran into malpractice, you know, he was angry at somebody. I mean, he tried to do a quality job, and if somebody else didn't, it made him mad. He didn't want to cover it up. He wanted to uphold the profession. But that's, you know, I think it's turned into the idea that if we admit that maybe there could be problems, then people will start asking too many questions.
I would like to add a couple of things to my thing that I think is important. With my case with the abuse, that I think is a good highlight. You know, the day that they, I did the protective order, the very next day, the father's attorney who's friends with all the judges somehow managed to dismiss the order without my presence. And my son was back with his father the very next morning. And the father pulls my child out of the school and never returns him back to school again after the abuse allegation. Until today, I don't know where my son's going to school this year because his dad is telling me it's none of my business. And he's been out of school.
What about CPS?
Let me tell you about CPS. CPS is friends with the two guardians at Lightham. So the CPS lady, I call her after the hearing, and she said, I told her, why didn't you, and I actually recorded this. I said, why didn't you tell the courts about the abuse when I took my son personally to your office? She says, well, I already told them that he was at the dad's house. He didn't tell me anything. I said, that was not when he told you the abuse. He's not going to tell you anything in front of his dad. He knows his dad records him. And she says, oh, well, the judge didn't ask me about the abuse, so I didn't think I needed to tell her about the other time he went.
So that anecdote she just explained also highlights another problem, which is that often they put people in position where it appears as though they have some sort of expertise, and they really don't. See, Ms. Guardian at Lightham is completely, in reality, completely unqualified to do any part of what she's tasked to do. But, you know, because almost anyone can be a guardian ad litem, they stick her in. They have no training in terms of figuring out if the abuse is real, in terms of talking to kids, to try to draw that out. I don't have any experience in any of that. And yet they're given the veneer that they have some sort of expertise, and then their opinion is treated as though it's really, really important, when in reality they have absolutely no expertise in any of this stuff. And unfortunately, what Natalia just described happens in so many courtrooms all around the country. And so you see parents getting crushed by people who have the veneer of having expertise, and in reality they have none. But they don't have a huge platform to point this out.
So there was two guardian at Lightham appointed to my case right here after the abuse. They after I filed the abuse and I asked for an emergency hearing because I didn't understand why my son went back to his father's house, the judge denied it in the JDR court and just assigned me as a back to the case. And she was like the old guardian at Lightham who helped the father to get custody. She was like on the father's side. I didn't want her back in the case, but anyways, they put her back. And I told her when I met her, I said, please, if you're going to be in this case, you need to look at this case with a new set of eyes, not be biased. And she said she wasn't going to be biased. Well, anyway, so then she gets in the case for a month. Yeah, she gets in the case for a month, and she's supposed to be like finding out about the abuse. So then I call her one day, and I record this too, and I said, so have you asked my child about the abuse? Oh, no, that's not my job. That's why they have CPS on board. I'm not going to ask him about those kind of questions. I said, so you're not going to ask him at all or have any conversation? No. So then later they assigned this. And so I asked, did you ask my son about the abuse? Oh, no. If he wants to voluntarily tell me, then he can. But I'm not going to ask him those kind of questions. That's not my job. So nobody is like, everybody's like snowballing,
John,
and they don't want to ask the child anything.
John, I want to ask you a question, which is, are there no standards between these specialties? Are there no standards? And I would assume that that's court district by court district. They come up with their own standards. I mean, it seems to me that if you're a guardian ad litem and you're supposed to be representing that child, you would want, and the expectation would be, that you would be asking and finding out everything that you could about that child.
As a lawyer, because they are typically lawyers, that would come within their responsibility, as any lawyer, to zealously advocate for their client and to represent them. But I challenged the guardian ad litem, and their position is, no, I'm not representing the child. I'm there to assist the court. That was her point of view, is that
that's
I said you're
from anything I've ever heard.
Yeah,
I thought the guardian ad litem was representing the person who couldn't represent themselves, i.e. the child.
Right. But no, her idea is that she's supposed to investigate and assist the court in understanding what's going on, not to represent the child's interests. And
wow.
Of course, there are any rules that exist, of course, if they're never enforced, they don't really exist. And of course, this gets back to your feeling about this whole thing, is that in any human endeavor, in any place, when there is no accountability, people go off track. Any amount of lack of accountability produces bad behavior. It's just human nature. And like with Natalia, she can appeal, but anyone trying to appeal faces the problem of coming up with the court reporter's transcripts. And she's got to come up with $4,200 for all the court reporter transcripts, and in many cases it's a lot more than that. So practically speaking, these judges never get challenged on appeal because nobody can afford it.
That's the problem. That's the problem I'm having now. I'm trying to get the money, and I don't have enough money.
Yeah, it's kind of like what was the saying about justice delayed is justice denied? It seems to me justice with a price tag is justice denied.
Absolutely, and
heard Natalia's evidence or allegations about abuse of her child from the custodial parent, but the custodial parent didn't go to jail. She did. Are there any allegations
right.
that she abused her child?
No, only that they're saying that she's bad mouthing the medical treatment, but there was no evidence that she ever did that before the child. She warned the adults that she had concerns that the medication was producing side effects, that he was having hallucinations, he was having tics and all kinds of things like that. But the allegation was that she's saying that to the child, of which there was absolutely no evidence whatsoever, because the only people who would know that would be Natalia and her child, Ethan, and they wouldn't let Ethan testify, and Natalia
and they wouldn't even hear Ethan.
Yeah.
I mean, so they found her guilty of turning Ethan against the medical treatment with no evidence whatsoever.
What statute is that?
Huh?
Is that on the books? I wondered. I have not seen that one. Not that I tore through law journals, but that's a funny time. Murder, mayhem. Yeah, I mean those kinds of things. I thought they had laws against. I didn't know that there was a law against. I don't know. I guess I'm pretty naive I think we are all very naive when it comes to the court systems until we find ourselves in a situation like this.
Michael, but that's where I asked let me finish, because that's where
ahead.
I asked the psychiatrist, what evidence do you have that the child was ever exposed to these concerns or opinions? Just none. I mean, he admitted there on the stand that there was no evidence whatsoever that Natalia ever said anything negative in the child's presence. And yet she was sent to jail for 4 days?
No, remember, it's 5 days.
Oh, right. Yeah, 5 days. Yeah, and that was,
yeah.
I mean, they were asking for 20, and it escalates from there. So it's not like they can't go higher if they want to.
And Heather,
go ahead,
note they also asked for a bunch of court costs. If they had gotten everything, Natalia would have been in jail for about a month, and she would have had like $30,000-$40,000 in extra court costs that she obviously doesn't have, which could then be used in all sorts of other ways if you can't pay the court costs.
They order supervised visits so that they can take all my money.
Right. Look, I firmly believe that it was reduced. I think the judge wanted a lot more, but there was enough media attention to this case that the judge at least backed away from the really harsh sentences. But I think if there weren't news stories and other things, I think Natalia would have gotten a full month and like the $30,000-$40,000 in court costs. So they wanted a lot more than she actually got.
Yeah.
So this is a.
Well, then they use the supervised visitation. Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to pay for that as well.
Yeah, they're using that to exhaust all my money so that I can't keep fighting. They even said that I need a neuropsychological evaluation before I can even go back to court again. And they know that I don't have the insurance or $5,000 to pay for that. So that's the way to keep me out of court.
Although they had previously, they had previously ordered that in, 2013 or something. And so when the attorney started to ask for that, for which there was no basis in the evidence whatsoever, there was no evidentiary basis at all laid for a psychiatric evaluation. And he started, going on and on about how that he thinks, in his opinion, in closing argument based on absolutely nothing, his, lack of medical knowledge, I popped up and said, oh, here it is. She already passed. And that just made the judge angry. She was getting all wound up that, oh, yeah, we have to order a psychiatric evaluation. When I pulled out that she'd already passed one, fine, the judge got angry. Well, that's not what we meant. We have to, we have to do it all over again.
Well,
so
only ordered it for me.
Yeah, yeah. And yet you have not been accused of abusing a child. Michael,
exactly.
It seems to me, Michael, that the go-to position in these cases are she's crazy.
Right. You know what it seems to me is the go-to position is whatever position creates more court costs. The go-to position is not so much that she's crazy, but that she needs a psychological evaluation, which costs $5,000. And she needs supervised visitation, which I think costs $150 or $300 an hour. It seems like whatever the position is, whatever is going to generate billable hours for someone, that's what it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And that's not a coincidence. That's why I keep getting back to it. There's only one court hearing while she had custody. And look at all of this stuff. This is all of this is what this is really all about. Her son is essentially like a pawn. What they really wanted to do was create a ton of billable hours for a lot of people so everybody can make money. And you couldn't do it with the right parents having custody. You can only do it this way. And, they basically don't care what happens to your son because it just creates so many billable hours. And if you can imagine all of these people multiply it exponentially in terms of the number of cases they have that they do this in, and then you can understand why they do it. You can create billable hours in 5, 10, 15 of these cases all at once, and you're $200 an hour. You're making a lot of money.
Oh, at least. But I was going to say, your audience should know that this whole thing about needing a psychiatric evaluation is a growing thing around a trend. I have that in several other cases, and even an attorney was suspended who was causing trouble with the judge in the bar. They suspended her license based on absolutely no evidence claiming that she needed a psychiatric evaluation. Again, these are not medical opinions. There's no medical basis for these orders, but it's a growing trend to just accuse somebody of, we need to get you to have a psychiatric evaluation.
It's kind of following a cultural trend that if you disagree with me, you must be crazy. I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, Michael, about the court industry, if you will, but it also seems to be, kind of culturally, we as a society seem to think that if you disagree with me, then you're crazy. That's what it is. So that's why we have to get you evaluated.
Right.
Is that kind of a thing unique to these kinds of situations, John?
I don't know. I mean, I think that they have hit on the fact that it works. And so now everybody's doing it. It's the new, you know, it's the new thing. Oh, and let me go off on another thing too, because I think that this father and his experts came up with a new idea, which is that, oh, the child needs stability, therefore the mother can't be involved. I mean, every time you want to say, well, let's accommodate the mother's schedule, let's make sure she gets involved, like, oh, no, we can't do that because it's so important for the child to have stability. And then, of course, the father yanks him out of school and is homeschooling him. So, you know, the expert said that he needs structure, he needs predictability, so he's being homeschooled. And I'm not against homeschooling, but I am against lying.
Right.
You know, he's getting less structure.
I can't believe that since there was a CPS case, I can't believe that if a child is pulled out of school, CPS isn't following up with that. I mean, that's just
raises red flags. Yeah, I can't either.
Yeah.
Because what happened?
She didn't even go to the father's house until like a week later after the report. Can you believe that? They lagged to jump into the case, like if it was not serious.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
So you have to understand this, that from the day after the magistrate did this, the father took the child away from any adult who might have a reporting responsibility. Since the magistrate ordered it, and then his attorney got it dropped, the only time the child has been around adults that might have a reporting responsibility, heard things from the child that required her to report to Child Protective Services that the child had reported being abused by the father. There's, you know, but being homeschooled means that this child is not in contact with any adults that would have any responsibility to deal with any abuse.
Yeah.
Natalia, were you the primary
caregiver? Yeah. For the first 6 years of Ethan's life, and because I moved to Fairfax, when I moved to Fairfax, that's how I lost custody. I was set up. It was a really sad story. The day that I was moving, I got a text from my lawyer and said that you just lost custody. And they said that I went to school, Ethan's school, disheveled with no shoes on. And ever since that day, I've been fighting to get custody back.
Right.
Michael, do you see this in these situations a lot where there's one thing, it's almost like somebody pushes a pebble down the hill and then you can't stop the avalanche in these cases?
Right. And one of the reasons for that is because it's like a huge can of worms they've created. You know, they can't reverse because then they got 4 years to explain for what they've done. So you've chosen a path. You can't go the other path because that creates all kinds of landmines for them. The other thing I wanted to point out is, I don't know if it's in this case, but the other thing that's being done is these kids then get drugged up. And so the pharmaceutical companies are making a lot of money off of this as well. See, they're having trouble dealing with the protracted divorce. The court never says we're protracting it. So let's put them on a whole bunch of drugs. Make sure the pharmaceutical industry makes a lot of money. The other thing I wanted to point out is, what you guys just talked about is another example of the essentially like moving the goalposts and then something being important in one case but not another. They're constantly saying stability, 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 but when he rips them out of school or homeschools him, well, suddenly stability is not so important. So stability is only important really just as a hammer to go after Natalia. They don't really care about stability. And if you analyze it right.
It's only stability when it comes to me, but when it comes to the father, even though he pulled my son out of school two times within the last, since the last court hearing, he pulled him out of the school that the judge wrote on her report to not take Ethan out of Mount Vernon, and he went ahead and pulled him out, and then he puts him in a private school that has no support for Ethan's emotional needs. So Ethan's like for a whole year in a private school where they have no specialist there to help him with his needs, and he's hitting kids and being suspended and being sent home all the time or whatever, and then he pulls him out of that school when I filed a protective order again. So within the 3 years of the last hearing, he's got pulled out of school twice. But, he's more you know, so no matter, and then also when I took, when I went and tried to get Ethan a year later after I lost custody, Judge Kimbler told me that if you come back in a year and let me, and show me that this child's behavior has decreased with this father and he's, his health has decreased, then I will give you back custody. No, that's not what happened when I went back to court. I brought her all the evidence of the nosebleeds and all the health issues that my son was having under medication and all this stuff, and she didn't listen. And then I brought her a list of behavior charts, and like all colorful of all the times he was suspended, how they did suicide threats on him, threat assessments on him. He was taking pieces of glass and going around trying to cut the kids on the playground. They put him in an isolated playground because of his behavior, and this was all under the father's care. The psychologist of Mount Vernon School even went to the school and said the child has become antisocial under the father's care. But, you know, the judge didn't care about those things. Even though I brought her all that evidence, she still left him with the father. So it doesn't matter what I bring to that court.
We started the show talking about, and I'm looking at the clock, folks, and I'm going, wow.
I'm sorry.
It's very tough. These stories are very tough, and they're so convoluted, and that's why I kind of keep trying to, you know, pull back to the one little tiny piece that I thought we could cover in an hour. It's very convoluted and very, you know, but one of the things that strikes me is one of the costs we talked about is the financial, obviously. It's very debilitating. You've had bankruptcy, and I've certainly heard that before. The other cost is the emotional cost. Boy, you know, how this must be for you, Natalia, but also for the child who's being bounced back and forth. And the emotional costs all around are just staggering. And yet we hear of this over and over again, but we're dealing with this kind of a situation in an environment where I still hear people say, well, if that mother lost her children, she must have done something wrong.
And a lot less people than 5 years ago.
Who say that?
A lot less people say if the mother doesn't have custody, she must have done something wrong. I think more and more people have had their eyes open that that's just nonsense. That's something the court wants to feed you. A lot of people still believe it, but I think it's far less than it was 5 years ago. A lot more of these stories have come out. A lot more people are wise to it. I'm not saying no one believes that, but a lot less than they used to.
Yeah, this is John Mosley. A lot of people, I used to say that there are two kinds of people, those who believe in our judicial system and those who have experienced it.
Wow.
You know, if you talk to people from afar, they're like, oh, it must be wonderful, but they, when they experience it, they have very different opinions.
Yeah, we tend to kind of idolize and set it on a pedestal as justice. From what I've seen, it has less to do with justice than it does with paperwork.
The thing, the other difficulty is that people say that, you know, like, oh, you're just saying this because you lost. Well, you're not going to hear it probably from the people who won. So if you're gonna learn that there are problems, are you gonna learn it from the people who lost, or are you gonna learn it from the people who won? So, but there's this automatic thing like, well, if there's criticism of what happens in the courts, well, that's just because you lost. You know, that's like saying that a patient comes into the emergency room. It's like, well, you're just making these complaints because you're sick, so we're not gonna listen.
Yeah. I've had where I've lost friends because they're like, we don't know what to believe anymore. And family members even stop talking.
Right. That comes from a fundamental misunderstanding of how the court works. And, it's because people, as John said, mostly experience it from afar. So they see something that they think is happening, and it's not happening. And they're basing their perceptions based on what they see happening. So if you're like, well, I'm sure it was fair. So Natalia lost custody. Oh, she must have done something really bad. And then you form your perceptions based on that.
Yeah, and I have a client recently who keeps wanting to know, you know, who do I report this to? And I have to say, no one. That, you know, the judge, that although a decision might be overturned on appeal, the judge doesn't work for anybody. The judge doesn't have a boss. The judge is not accountable to anybody. You might be able to get the decision reversed by the appeals court, but it's still not, they're still not their boss. They're completely independent, you know, with no accountability.
Well, and you hear people discussing this problem by saying, well, you know, some areas elect judges, and I was just talking to somebody this morning, and we're, you know, reasonably well-informed, reasonably well-educated people, and we're going, when we vote for a judge, do we even know that person? I mean, do we even know? No, of course we don't. And, you know, or in, if you don't, in, you know, in areas where you don't elect judges, where they don't get voted for, they get appointed. Well, but then you've got the cronyism issue. So it's like, how are these people selected and who keeps track of them? And how do we know that they've been given a cartload full of authority and power and they're sitting there by themselves? And at the most, they're going to get a little hand slap if they do something that comes to the attention of, you know, their colleagues. It's a tough one. It's a tough one. And again, I'm looking at the clock right now, and I'm going, we could keep talking about this for hours. John Mosley, thank you very, very much. Michael Volpe, thank you. Natalia, thank you. And you have my strongest good wishes. And dealing with this, it's a tough burden for you to hold. And thank you for coming on the show and talking about it. Thank you, John. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Natalia.
Thank you.
Join us next week for Three Women, Three Ways.